So we're going to start the conversation now. So this was an idea with Elgin and Rika and me, and I think it's just been circulating the internet and the X-Munich community to talk about purity culture and what that means. And so in order to do that, I realize it's a diverse and dynamic experience, shared experience. And so I reached out to as many people as I felt comfortable with. And right now we have a panel of us to talk about what purity culture was in the Unification Church and what that meant. So I'm Renee, and we'll just go around and introduce ourselves as comfortable as we feel.
Okay, my name is Misuk. I'm 28. I was born into the Unification Church in Brazil, and I've moved like 15 times in my life. And now I live in New Jersey, and I've been living here for a while now, since I was 10. And I'm a nurse for the last 3 years, and I'm in grad school to become a licensed therapists and psych mental health. So.
Hi, my name is Becca. I'm from Germany. I was also born into the Unification Church. I'm gonna be 37 in a couple of weeks, and I left the church 20 years ago next year. And I still live in Germany. And yeah, that's me. I'm a pastry chef, but that's, of no matter to this conversation.
Amazing. Thank you.
So I'm Rika, and I was born into it. I also moved a lot. I was in Korea. My parents were the GOP dorm parents when Renee was there. And I grew up like at UTS and like several other, well, the Jefferson House in Virginia. And so yeah, like a lot of moving around with the church. So currently I do research in this area on primarily like violence. I do like violence prevention projects and like extremist violence prevention. And then I also work on like reintegration and rehabilitation of youth and families coming back from formerly Islamic State controlled territories. So this is very much in line with all of the research that I'm doing. And I'm in Boston currently.
Beautiful. Thank you. I am so honored to have you guys on the show. So we're going to be talking about reintegration into society post purity culture. But first, we have to lay down what is purity culture? What does that even mean? It's kind of a new buzzword that's been floating around on the internet. I just educated myself on what it was at the beginning of this year, and it hit all of the ambiguous injuries that I've been surviving post UC. I just, you didn't have words for what you were feeling or how disconnected you were from your body or how sex might have been painful or how physical touch and intimacy might have felt like assault. I didn't have words for that. But once I stumbled upon the word purity culture, everything started to make sense. And so now we're going to talk about how it applied to the Unification Church, because even though there's purity culture on the internet, it's still not translated into Muni lingo. And specifically, I feel like we had different words for sexual relationships, like conjugal relationships, horizontal relationships. Instead of sin, we called it fallen nature. So everything is kind of translated and harder for to understand. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
So I kind of just wanted to talk about that. How did it influence you? When was your first incidence with purity culture? When was the first time you realized it wasn't okay to be yourself, or that the idea of sexual purity was the most important aspect of your value?
I can start because I'm oldest, so my recollection goes back furthest, I think. So in like the early 90s, when I was in grade school or elementary school, I remember so vividly being told that I don't have to like have crushes at kindergarten because I don't need them because my husband is out there already and I don't have to go look for him. So I kind of grew up with the thinking that I'm already promised, which is weird. And yeah, not being able to choose my own partner was kind of big theme for me. Like, I know it changed over the years, and after LF, people started just, you know, marrying their crush within the church, which is also a caveat, but yeah. And also being told that you are, regardless of how you feel about it, you have to be a parent because you have to produce another generation. It's also kind of, I think, a big part of it, because then it means you have to protect your bloodline and also bloodline in itself. And this is all before the whole formality happened, like with the pledges and the rings and all that shabazz. I think it goes back far further than I realized in the beginning, because at first I only thought about these like formal stuff that you talk about with your peers, but it all happens like from the get-go with your mother's milk, basically.
Wow.
You left at 18, right?
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
Were you, up until 18, were you still believing in it, or did you feel like you, like, in your mind, like, left prior?
It was quite sudden, actually.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I left very, very young myself. Like, I wanted out by like not 10, 11 probably. Yeah. And so it's funny when you say like when you were told like you don't need to have crushes in like kindergarten, because I remember specifically being like in, oh gosh. So when I lived in West Virginia, I feel like I had a relatively normal life. I went to public school, and like I actually at one point, and I think it was in like maybe second or third grade, before I left for Korea, because I moved to Korea at 9. So around this age, I had like a boyfriend, like a cute little like in school crush boyfriend. And my parents knew about it. And like I would call him from like the house phone and like talk to him like every few days or something after school. And like they were okay with this. And then we moved to Korea, and like you can take the name out, but Jerry Tamayo. I don't know if Renee, do you know her?
I think her name deserves to stay in, because yeah, she destroyed so many lives.
I mean, yeah, it's so okay. When she first saw me, because like when we first arrived at GOB, and I was so angry that we were like having to move to Korea, because I was like, I'm leaving all my friends. Like, I think I broke up with this boyfriend, because I don't even know. I was feeling myself, you know, as an 8-year-old, I was just feeling myself. But then very shortly after that, like my parents were like, oh, we're moving to Korea. And I had like a whole bunch of friends, and I was like, I don't want to leave my friends. And so we went to Korea, and the first thing Jerry Tamayo says to me when she sees me is like, oh, you need to go change your shirt because it's too revealing. And I was like 9 years old, and I'm like, all right, I'm going to listen to this.
What was it even revealing?
Yeah, what was I revealing? Exactly. Like, I don't think I had, I mean, I did get my period very young at 9, but still, like, like, you don't need to say that to a 9-year-old. And I listened to her because I was scared of her, like everyone else. But, like, that was the first time I think that I was like, oh, like, this is something that is frowned upon to be, like, a sexual being, I guess. And then I think that first year that I was at GOB, I, like, had a crush on one of the boys. And I think like I told one of the sisters, and like she told my dad. And so then he like came in storming into the room. He was very angry and he was very upset. And he just like, it was like this very like weird exchange of like, he was like, you're not, I heard that you had like this crush on this boy and you're not supposed to have a crush. And he didn't even like, so the thing that was going through my head was like, oh, is this because like I have like a future husband that I'm supposed to marry or whatever? And he actually, he was, instead of saying that, he was like, oh, you're not supposed to have feelings like that for anyone. And like, I'm supposed to be the only guy in your life. And that was really like, I don't know, like this weird, like incestuous, like it was fucked up. It was very like gross. And I felt like angry and upset. And I was an offering child, and my mom, who adopted me, she clearly didn't want kids, like, ever. And so she was a very abusive mom. And so I think, like, growing up as a kid, I was like, why am I with this mom? Why was I given up to this mom who didn't want kids? Like, she didn't treat me very nicely. So clearly she didn't want me. So like, why would you want a kid anyway? And so I think when my dad came in and like confronted me about this crush, that was the moment where it sort of all like came together in my head of like, I'm going to be married off to somebody I don't know, and I'm going to have kids. And I want neither of those things. I don't want to get married, and I don't want to have kids, because I don't want to be a person like my mom was. And so like just having that, like knowing at 9 that you're going to be married off, that's like, I mean, this happens all over the world, but it's just wrong, you know?
Yeah.
There's so many things in those, just those two stories alone.
Yeah, that was a lot of layers that like I haven't even unpacked totally.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so much. First, there's the hypersexualization of children with Jerry. And then there's the grooming for marriage that Becca said in kindergarten. Don't worry about your feelings, because we've got somebody planned for you. Grooming for the marriage trafficking. Then there's the peer policing, with somebody reporting to your parents that you had normal feelings for a boy that you've lived with. And then the shame and guilt and compartmentalizing sexuality. And that is such a damaging thing to do, because sexuality is part of our whole being. And from a very young age, we're told to cut that off, put it in a box. That doesn't exist. Don't worry about it. It'll be abandoned, neglected, and damaged until you get married and you can take it out of the box, and all of a sudden it works. But it's like, that's not how sexuality works. That's not how sexual health and wellness work.
Yeah. And if you think about the age, it's like before we even had a chance to start exploring it, like 6 to 9 to 11 years old. Like, if you really think about like the age, like I can't even wrap my head around how young we were.
I was just thinking about like this weird thing that women are thought of as gatekeepers of not only our own sexuality, but also men's reaction to our bodies, which is why they tell little girls to cover up. It also is like a big part of the whole purity culture thing, because it just means that men are not to be held accountable at all for their actions, which bleeds into rape culture heavily.
What were the boys told? Remember when they would like separate the girls from the boys?
I don't know. Like, I want to know.
Like, what were the boys told? Like, were they told like, oh, like, you're, I'm sure they were told that their urges were also like sinful, but also like, was there the same level of like, oh, they're not going to be as blamed?
So I remember, just going back to the goth where we grew up, the boys were told like wear a shirt in the hallways. Don't look at sisters with wet hair. Don't look at sisters while they're eating. Don't sit with the sisters. Boys and girls are always, girls on the left, boys are on the right. Don't talk with sisters after a certain time, or don't walk with a sister like four feet close to a sister. Make sure if you're talking with a sister, do it with another brother. Make sure it's a group activity. Don't ever have one-on-one conversations. If there's a sister playing sports, make sure there's at least two of them. Like, pretty much just like this really weird dynamic of like, you can't trust yourself with the opposite sex, and you shouldn't trust yourself, because who knows what you're going to do. And they would send like naked boys down our hallways, like without a shirt on and maybe a towel, just to fuck with us. like, I don't remember, know if you remember this, like running through the boys' hall or running through the girls' hall was like a joke we angsty teenagers did just to like.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I would run down the boys' hall every once in a while.
Did you have to yell sister in the hall?
Yes, we were supposed to yell okay. Sister in the hall.
Because, mm-hmm. like, I also, when I lived there the first year, we were in, like, the dorm parents' room, which was in the middle of the boys' hall. And, like, I was told that I had to, like, yell sister in the hall every time I wanted to go to and from
house.
And I was like a 9-year-old scared shitless. And then I remember the boys would like, the boys would fuck with me. Like,
they would hoot and holler. They'd take off their shirts. And they'd like,
oh, I'm naked. And I'm like, I can't even get home. Like, I just want to go to my room.
It's so weird. It's so weird that the boys could get away with like doing that. Like they were intentionally fucking with us. And it was like, oh, boys will be boys. Like let them hoop and holler and antagonize these girls just trying to walk through the hall. But if a girl did that, oh my God, I got kicked out of GOP for having feelings. Like if a girl did that, God forbid, we would be punished. We would be sent to Chumpyung for 21 days or 40 days and locked in a hospital and given benzodiazepines against our will. Like it was very much a different it was very different treatment, but I don't know, I haven't talked to one of the brothers I really love, and I called them brothers from muscle memory, but I would love to talk to one of the guys that grew up in purity culture in the Unification Church to see what kind of damage that had, because I know like if it's damaging to us, that damage doesn't stay with us, it permeates and it goes through all the relationships in so many different ways that we probably can't even fathom.
Who did everybody do that ring ceremony thing?
Ilshim
ring? I remember doing that in seventh grade. Yeah.
The True Love Waits rings. I remember that. It was, it concluded with a 3-day fast, children starving themselves to prove that they would save their sexual purity for God.
At 12 years old.
Yeah, this is very normal, actually. It's not just, no, this is not normal.
Okay, you're joking.
Getting kids to starve themselves and wear a ring to pledge their, I don't know, bodily fluids to none other than what this one Korean dude says. It's, I don't know.
Also, what I was thinking was, so like this was already after I left the church that I was speaking with one woman who was in the church. And she said that, you know, like she told when she first married her or was blessed to her husband, she said, you know, like, if you ever hit me or my children, I don't care what the church says, I'm going to divorce you. And I remember like when she told me that, I was like, you know, that's a thought that I had too when I was much younger. I was like, wait, like if the church is so against divorce, and you're not allowed to divorce at all or leave your husband ever after you get married, then like, what do you do if he's hitting you? What do you do if you're in like a situation where like, you might get killed? Like,
The answer to that is you probably deserve it. And that's just indemnity you're paying.
Yeah.
I recently realized how much women in the church must have been traumatized because they had no other option. They couldn't get divorced. So they had to just internalize it or like suppress it to try to like manage and then raise us.
That's the intersection with mental health. Like my mother became bipolar schizophrenic, but she compartmentalized her trauma so much, her personality split. She had the part that was traumatized, but then she had to cut that off and put that in a box to be the person to still survive. And it's so much damage, so much damage. I can only imagine what that's like, but you see it in these mental health disorders that manifest as well. It compartmentalized these parts of yourself, your trauma, your sexuality, your church self, your fallen nature, even just fallen nature, quote unquote, a lot.
I had like a 24-hour fast that I had to do for this ring ceremony or whatever. And like, I was how old? Seventh grade. So that's like 12, 13-ish. I was already like drinking at this point and like doing drugs and stuff. So I was like not into this at all. yet. So I actually, so I said I was fasting. I actually ate a bowl of cereal. I cheated, like, very close to the end of the 24 hours. I was like, I'm hungry. Like, I don't want to do this. So I ate a bowl of cereal. And then I remember that day, like, it was a Sunday, and it was like right after church service that the 24 hours was supposed to end. And I remember the clock in the room stopped working, like, right before, like, 15 minutes before it was supposed to end. And so I was sitting there for like half an hour past the time waiting for this clock to change. And then somebody was like, oh, wait, that clock just broke. And like, despite me not believing in all of this bullshit, I still like took that as like, oh no, like maybe I'm wrong. Like maybe there is like this God that's like smiting me for, and like, it was like this magical thinking that I couldn't get out of my head. Or like when you, do you remember being told like, oh, your ancestors are watching you all the time. So if you do something like touch yourself or think dirty thoughts, and they're like in your head, they know exactly what you're thinking. Mm-hmm. And like, yep. I remember literally like trying to stop myself from thinking certain things or do like touching myself or masturbating or like any of that, because I was like, oh, like these ants, these spirits, these ghosts are like watching me, or they're gonna know, or it's gonna be so embarrassing when I die and I go to heaven or whatever. And then I have to be like shown like a replay of all the bad things that I did. And it was such fuckery at like 6, 7, 8 years old.
That is very real. I remember them saying Reverend Moon can see your thoughts and read your aura, and he knows like how much, you know, all your sexual impurities, quote unquote. So that fear was really, really real of yeah, not masturbating, not touching yourself, total mind body disconnect. Oh, what would they call it? Mind body unity was actually right. You completely ignoring your body's needs. For instance, in the 3-day fast, that was you totally ignoring all of your body cues, all of your built-in body wisdom, totally shutting it out and just getting further and further into the cult theology of like mind body unity, when really it was Reverend Moon's control of your body. You are just a product.
The thing with mind body unity and starving yourself and stuff like that, I think I recently figured out that I have real trouble recognizing when I'm hungry or thirsty. Sometimes I will be not drinking and going to the hospital because my kidneys are shit now, because I don't feel thirst anymore. And I always thought like, this is so weird. Same with hunger. I get jittery, my hands get shaky. And then I realized, shit, I have not eaten all day. And I wonder if this is, you know, me just still being conditioned to just ignore what my body needs.
This is,
does anyone else feel this way?
Yes. No, this is, I've had this talk with my therapist. Actually, it is a result of trauma. And it's really? Like, I have gone to a nutritionist. I've gone to food therapist, because I have the opposite problem. I can't tell when I'm full. Like, I was like binging, and I would just keep eating and eating, and I couldn't tell when my body was telling me I was full until I was like uncomfortable to the point of like, I wanted to throw up. And so it would volley between the like, and then I would be like, oh, I'm eating too much, I'm getting fat, like, let me just starve myself. And then I wouldn't know when to eat. And so it kept volleying between me being like so hungry that I'm starving myself because I can't tell when I'm starting to get hungry, to like, oh, I'm starving, let me eat, and then binging so much that I'm so full and like getting sick. And I've worked on that specifically, like trying to like sit and like not have any electronics, like literally like stare at my food, focus on every single bite that I'm taking, to like tell like my body, like listen to my body and be like, okay, how does that feel? How does it feel after this bite? How does it feel after this bite? Do I feel full now? Like, and it has taken me probably like the last 2 years to like start to feel like I have a grasp on this.
Yeah, I never even thought about that.
Do you guys have Misa?
Yeah,
definitely had a lot, like, just as a dancer too, I definitely had like body dysmorphia issues where when I wasn't fat, I thought I was. And so like I had this like obsessive control, like wanting to control what I ate, so much, and like feeling like insanely guilty because I used food as comfort. I've always used food as comfort, and now I know that like there's nothing wrong with using food as comfort. A lot of people do that. Food is not good or bad, you know. It took me a long time to get there, and I have a lot of talks with my sister who studied nutrition in college. We talk about it a lot because she researches that a lot. But I had such an unhealthy relationship with food, and yeah, it was just like me wanting to control it so much. But as a nurse too, it was when I started working as a nurse that I realized how much I can ignore my body and like not pee for like almost 10 hours. And I'm like, this is not a skill that I should be practicing. This is not a skill that I should be good at. Like, but that's what I was practicing. And I know it stemmed from the what we were taught growing up, that I was like, I was so focused on being good at that. And I'm like, wait, this is not healthy. And I had to, I was taking care of, when I first started working as a nurse, I was taking care of 8 patients, and I had to consciously make myself a 9th patient so that I could think about myself, so that I could ask, did I pee enough? Because I'm thinking about how, did my patients pee enough? Did they eat enough? And so I had to ask myself that, did I drink enough? Did I pee enough? Like, and I had to make myself a 9th patient in order to consider my needs at work.
A really powerful method. I'm actually really glad you said that, because that, I mean, that's baby steps to healing, isn't it? To prioritize yourself as equal to everyone that you're taking care of. And I think reflecting on the food control in the purity culture, because that was a very real step to get your purity ring, is that we were hyper-controlled. Every aspect of our life was controlled. Is it possible that we took that out on what we ate or how we managed our bodies? And that created some damaging habits because of the amount of control, is what I'm thinking. Yeah, it's just really damaging to treat your body like it's not important, and to disregard your intuitive wisdom and to surrender your body to a cult leader.
It's crazy. A cult leader that also, sorry,
go ahead. No, it's crazy how much we talked about mind-body unity. But that all that meant is that we had to ignore our bodies over and over. Like, it's just like how opposite it was from that. Like, we weren't connected to our bodies at all, even though we talked about our bodies. They can say we talked about sex, we talked about our bodies, but it was all like from Moon's perspective, like just from the cult's perspective.
And lies too. Like, no way in hell does this man, like, did this man survive decades on 3 hours of sleep a day?
Yes. Or like, oh, he didn't eat for 40 days. I'm sorry. Yeah. What? Mm-hmm.
That's called cocaine, guys.
Yes.
Oh, I saw a woman do the 40-day fast because she heard Moon did it. And she was near her deathbed when I saw her on like the 37th day. Oh, it was so traumatizing. It was like seeing a skeleton, and she had a family, and she was completely neglecting her family to live in Moon's shoes. And I'm like, you've been gone for 40 days, like in this bed, debilitated, unable to eat because of Reverend Moon telling you this bullshit, and you're about to die. A woman in Chumpyong did a 40-day fast and did die. A Japanese sister. She died in Chumpyong trying to emulate Reverend Moon's bullshit words.
Yeah.
And you know somebody else. This 3-day fast, the 3-day fast was working us up, that working us up to a 7-day fast for the blessing, which I completed, which was absolutely torture. And then you're expected to do a 40-day fast. Really?
My mom was at a 40-day workshop at Chumpyong, and she would like, this was when I was in Korea, and she would like give us a call every couple of days or whatever to like check in, to tell us, you know, what was going on. And I was with my dad. And so she had it called for like a week and we were like, huh, like, I wonder if she's okay. And so when she finally did call, she said she was in the hospital because she like collapsed because she hadn't been eating or drinking and had been climbing that goddamn mountain like twice a day. And they had to put her on IV fluids, her and like several other people. And it's like, do you not realize that when you're in a hospital hooked up to an IV because you're not eating or drinking enough, like that probably means that you should reevaluate some of the things you're doing to your body.
Yeah. And I think that's where it stems because that branched out into so many other things. There was the initial control with the food, but then that stems into a disconnect emotionally, sexually, mm-hmm. so many other things. There's so many other disconnects with our bodies. We've compartmentalized, and how do you get back from that? So we're making the point that purity culture has in the Unification Church has done this, and it's bled into so many different aspects, from body dysmorphia, viewing yourself as a whole person, to sexuality, to food control.
And control over pressure, pleasure. Because food can be a source of pleasure. So if you're controlling already what we feel like we can eat, and we're not in tune with our food needs, of course we're not going to be in tune with our sexual needs. Like, of course we're going to repress that too. Like, I don't know.
And our emotional needs. It's prepping you to handle an abusive relationship. It doesn't matter what your husband does to you. Just like it doesn't matter how much you eat. You can survive it, obviously, of mind-body unity, right?
Right. Did you also have this, like, I felt like, okay, if I ate, like, half a pizza, of course I would feel, like, nauseated because I just stuffed myself, like, to the brim with pizza. But I also would, like, I would beat myself up and like be like, you're so terrible. You just ate the worst food ever. And you just ate so much of it. You can't control yourself. And it had these like similar, the type of like guilting that I was doing to myself and like calling myself like fat and like having no willpower and like, you're just terrible. And all of these things had parallels with like when I would masturbate when I was younger or when I would have sex when I was older, like I would get those same feelings after of like, you're a terrible person. Like you can't control yourself. Like you have no willpower.
The other way around. Like I berate myself for not being able to take care of myself. Like, what are you? You're 37 almost, and you can't even drink like 1 liter of water. What's wrong with you?
Oh my gosh. The way you have the relationship with food is how I had the relationship with my emotions. So I didn't realize I was in love with certain people in my teen years. I didn't realize that's what it was. That's how serious the emotional disconnect was, is I wouldn't register my feelings of desire as desire, but it felt painful. Mm-hmm. So for my feelings towards these boys, I would start to cut myself. And I didn't know why. Like I would be writing in my journal and just write their name. Like I just had to write their name. I don't know why. And when I think of them, I cut myself and it feels better. And I don't know why, but at least that's something. So there was this emotional disconnect and I would punish myself for having really natural feelings to people and unable to even express it to myself because that's how compartmentalized those feelings were. I knew that they were bad. Even subconsciously, I wouldn't allow myself to acknowledge that I loved somebody or that I cared for somebody because that wasn't okay.
That's just you surviving though, right? That's just you taking care of yourself, because acknowledging the feelings means that you have to confess, which means that you will have to be punished. Mm-hmm. And that's horrifying.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I don't want to do that again. That happened, you know, it happens one time. I'm sure it just has to happen one time for your subconscious to realize it has to kick into gear to protect you, to survive. And it'll keep things from you that would hurt you, like feelings. Yeah, like, yeah. And it's hard to build that bridge again after so many years. And I feel like that story is kind of similar with you, Rico, with registering food and registering feelings and registering sexuality. And I know we haven't even really touched on the sexuality, but there's just so many intersections of all these other aspects of control and shame and guilt for just being a person.
I mean, even now, like, I'm 28 and I've had so much therapy, like over a decade of therapy. And like, especially I've noticed like the past couple of years, I've had a lot of trouble like identifying if I do like somebody, if I do have feelings towards somebody. And it's like, it's almost like I shut that down. Because it's like, I wanted to like separate the sex from the feelings. So I would just like be like, okay, I'm going out and dating, not to like find somebody that I like or find somebody that I have feelings for, but to just like find someone to have sex with.
Yeah, that's real. I think once your body gets so good at it, it's like the inability to be vulnerable, even to yourself. And you survive however you have to. And if that's separating sex from emotions, that's what we were trained to do. If you think about it, that
also those Ansu sessions.
Yeah.
Who else did go to that? Yeah. Yeah.
Mine was fairly early on. There wasn't like a whole program and there wasn't fees to be paid yet.
Okay.
It was super duper early. I don't know. I think it was like 16 or something. So fairly late in my like right before I left, and I didn't really know what was going to happen. Actually, it's kind of weird. I just wanted to see my friends, to be honest. And I was living pretty far south in Germany, and all my friends were living right either in central Germany or in northern Germany, so I couldn't see them all the time.
Yeah.
And then there was this woman called Demonim coming to freaking Hamburg, and then I was like, oh, guess I'll be going because all my friends are going. And then it was this whole thing. And I literally did not know what was going to happen. And it freaked me out. And I cried. And it was terrifying. And my mom was in the back of the hall. And she was out already in her mind. She and my dad, they left the cult a couple of years before I did. And so she just... She forgot that I was there, actually. I talked to her this year about this, and she was like, what? Why were you there? And I was like, I want to see my friends, man. But yeah, no, that shit was terrifying. And to subject a child against their will to do so, knowing what was going to happen to them, that's just, no. Intolerable.
So I just wanted to pause it there to insert a bit of information just to highlight how excessively violent the Ansu sessions were. So the woman Sun-ae Hong, later named Daemonim, the mother of Hak-ja-han Moon, was jailed for 2 years in 1957 for beating to death an 18-year-old boy through excessive Ansu. I will link that in the show notes. But I want it to be known that an 18-year-old boy was murdered in an Ansu session. And that is just to highlight how abusive these situations are and how much we don't know about what went on behind closed doors with medical Ansu and special Ansu and just Ansu around the world in general. I wanted to stop there and just add that. We were rightly terrified of Ansu because this boy died. And that needs to be remembered.
I had been going to these since before I could remember, like probably 2, 3.
That just straight up should not be allowed.
Yeah. And so like, I remember going, so like, if you start going, you know, every year, every other year, starting at that age and you grow up with it, it's sort of, they groom you into thinking that this is like, you know, normal, or at least tolerating it. You know, I didn't like going, and it was and like when Hainom talked to Elgin on his podcast, he was like, you know, like he explained the whole like concept of Ansu, and he was like, the first one I think to actually, you know, say what it was for what it was and not sugarcoat it. And, you know, he was like, they would like open hand slap yourself in all these different parts because they had like bad spirits, and like your sexual parts would have sexual bad spirits, and like, and he was like, that's the only part that they really explained. And I'm just like, yeah, it's true. They only really focused on that. And like these other areas are there, they would be like, oh, like if you get headaches, like hit your head more. But it was always when, in terms of like when I thought of Ansu, it's like the first thing that I would think about would be like, oh, like you would have to like hit yourself in your groin area, or like have somebody else hit your like butt. And like, it was uncomfortable.
It was, it's sexual assault when somebody would be slapping your ass for, you know, hours. It was so uncomfortable. I remember like, now that I have the words, it was like in grooming people to endure sexual assault. Because they would touch your, sometimes they would slap your vagina. They would touch your butt. And then sometimes they'd go under. And it was really, and this is as a teenager, like coming into puberty, like being groomed to have other people touch your private parts because it's for your own good, or just grooming you to normalize self-harm and self-harming behavior as a good thing in the masses. Like, can you imagine what that does on a social level?
I didn't know about the touching your private parts.
Yeah.
Like that was with children and young adults and teenagers. Mm-hmm. Jesus fuck.
And
yeah.
And like, I remember for me, I would force myself to dissociate. Because I was like, I don't want to be in this room, but I have to be. And I don't want to be in this room, like right next to my parents doing this. So I would like force myself to leave my body. And I realized, you know, into my early, starting in my early 20s into like now, even I would dissociate anytime I had sex with somebody. I would need to have alcohol. I would need to be very drunk. It's very rare that I will have sex sober.
Yeah. I mean, these are practices you should have never been doing. Mind body disconnect. Like that's not something that's not normal. And it echoes for a long time. I totally relate to you. Even in a loving marriage with my husband, for the last 7 years, I've been on cruise control, and sex wasn't something I was mentally in. Mm-hmm. It was an act, performative, because I had been taught that sex is a transaction. It's not about you. It's about giving yourself to your partner. And I was taught and internalized that. And I've been seeing a therapist and been getting better at being in my body. Aftercare is important. Communicating your needs, what feels good, what you want somebody to do, what your boundaries are. It's okay if you don't like everything. It's okay if you like certain things. Like being able to communicate honestly with yourself is a practice that I've been engaging in, and it's helped myself heal from purity culture in a real way, because I'm 31 and I'm still struggling with so many of these things that we've been talking about in so many different aspects of my life. And like what it comes down to is like we practice mind body disconnect in Ansu, during fasting, during speeches, like, and it's about healing that, undoing all of that damage that we were trained and encouraged to do as young children. And like it's not easy.
Can we also talk about how there's no talk about consent whatsoever, and also beside from scare tactics, no real talk about how to protect yourself from STIs and sexual assault. And like, I mean, these are things that happen within the cult as well.
Yeah.
But once you leave it and you enter the outside world and dating, it gets real complicated, man.
Yeah. We can talk about abstinence-only education. It's been proven that it does not work to prevent teen pregnancies or STDs. It works opposite. People that have an abstinence-based education only tend to get STIs, STDs, and pregnant statistically way more than an all-encompassing sex education. So yeah, one of the first times I started having sex with somebody, I got an STI. Abstinence only education. Sure, it was cured with penicillin. A lot of the STIs are cured with penicillin, but they can be avoided by using condoms, by getting tested, by vetting your partners, and just having, you know, prophylactic treatment. Like, if you have something, don't worry, get it treated, get your penicillin shot. Like, don't spread it. Be honest. Open communication. It's not something to be ashamed of.
I think shame is super important to mention it, because a lot of people, and that's not, I don't think that even limits to people who grew up in like restrictive cults and everything, but I think just being ashamed of STIs is just a general thing. But it's just so common. It's so fucking common. Can I say something? Maybe this is off-putting, but I was diagnosed with a very easily curable STI last year, and I had to call so many people. I had to call like 16 people because it was over a span of the last 6 months that I had to, you know, tell all the people that I've been in bed with. And that was good training, I gotta say. And it took all the shame away. I was like, dude, you gotta get checked. I was like, girl, you need to get checked. Like, I was doing that for days. It really helped me, I gotta say.
Yeah, and like, well, talk about STIs. The worst one they stigmatize is HIV and AIDS. But guess what? HIV and AIDS can be very well controlled, so much so that the viral load is almost undetectable. Yeah. So if you're going to shame people with STDs and STIs, that's not going to work anymore. Everything is treatable. Everything is treatable.
Yeah. And I remember, like, I got my first STI last year. And at first I was, you know, like, I freaked out. And even before that, it was similar to when I first got like a abnormal pap smear back, and they were like, you have HPV, and like, what, 80-90% of the population has HPV.
Yeah.
And similar statistics for different types of STIs. And like, me, as like, I work in mental health, like, I know, you know, like, theoretically, I know, like, this shouldn't be stigmatized. It's like, it should be normalized more. And like, it is curable. Like you said, you know, it's not like I have stage 4 cancer, but I still felt like I was like dirty or like impure, or I don't even like a terrible person just because of this. And it's like, no, it's not the end of the world. And I had to tell myself that so many times, and even now, you know, still, like, it's taken a while to, like, get to that.
While we're on the topic of STDs and STIs, I just wanted to point out that abstinence-only education, the most dangerous thing about that is the miseducation. Like we said, STIs can be treated, but if STIs are ignored and the symptoms are just completely ignored, they can cause serious issues. And that's the real danger of STIs, is ignoring your body's cues that you have an infection, because that's all it is. It's just an infection. Bacterial infection, viral infection, whatever it is, it's just an infection. Infections can be treated with modern day medicine. But if you ignore chlamydia or gonorrhea, it can turn into PID, and it's extremely painful. It can cause infertility. If you ignore syphilis, it can cause spinal lesions and lesions on the brain, which cause you to go crazy. So these are real side effects of miseducation and ignoring your body's cues that something's wrong. So if you feel like something's wrong, listen to your body. It's going to be okay. There are medications you can take. The worst thing you might get is a shot, but it's manageable. And in no way does having an STI change your worth as a human being. And that is one thing I really wanted to drive home. That's like saying if you get pneumonia, you're trash. It's equivalent. It doesn't make any sense. So don't let that shame you into staying in some crazy sex cult. Just wanted to put that in there while we were talking about it.
And then also going to your point of like consent, like I in that Ilsham like ceremony, and like And even like in all of so many of Moon's speeches, when he would talk about like, oh, when you're married, like you have to like whatever your husband wants, you will happily give it to him because you're there to serve his needs. And like, it was the opposite of consent, you know? And it's like, when I first started dating around and having sex, like I clearly did not understand what consent was. And a lot of the things that I look back on now and I'm like, that was assault. And I just had no idea. And like, you're right. It isn't just a cult thing. It is a societal thing. Like more people in society need to understand what consent is, but like, especially when you're groomed from birth to consent or to accept non-consent, to like, to open yourself up and to being taken advantage of, like that's especially hard to like undo. And
for people that are listening that aren't in the Unification Church or never were exposed to what Reverend Moon was talking about, I have some experts. He would, from a book, he would talk about positions for lovemaking. He would talk about specifically like, what if anal sex was allowed, or if ejaculating in a woman's mouth or hand is allowed. And like, here's just one little expert. They're like, what about ejaculation outside the wife's body to her hand or mouth? Is it right or wrong? He said it is allowed during menstruation, after childbirth, or during health problems. To recover from childbirth is good to drink her husband's sperm, father said at the talk to the Japanese wives. Immediately after childbirth, insertion is not allowed because it can be painful. So you can use different methods. Semen is not poisonous. Damonim also said that women should learn to give the kiss in the hole of the throat, but husbands should not demand it. So they're telling us that we should have children and then immediately suck our husband's dicks or jack them off. But the husbands shouldn't demand it. So like, we were groomed to be performative and be serving. Like, these are things he said. Like, it wasn't just ambiguous. It was direct orders. Like, after childbirth, you can suck your husband's dick. It's not just because it hurts, not because you just gave birth to a child and you should be like doing your own thing for 6 weeks and rest and recover. It's like, nah, you gave birth, like open your mouth.
Like, and not because you should ask yourself, do I even want to have sex? Like, yeah, that was the question you asked yourself. Like,
where's the consent?
You don't consider that at all.
There was no, like, if you want to do it, if it feels good. It's just like, as long as the husband doesn't demand it, make sure you offer. Like, that's not consent.
I brought up the excerpt that Donna and Elgin brought up in their Logical Fallacies episode of how, I think it was that episode where they're talking about one of Moon's speeches where he was like, oh, like the American woman is so corrupt and she's so impure and needs to like fill her vagina with concrete. And I was like, this is violent. Like, that's sexual violence.
Yeah. No, you're right. We were sexually harassed. This is called sexual harassment by Moon for decades. And people are calling him true father and true mother, but like, this is all sexual assault. Like, listen to one speech. Does he ever talk about consent? Does he ever talk about the woman, how they feel? How are your feelings? What the mind body unity is talking about is just being subjugated and totally ignoring all of your feelings and your needs. And yeah, it's just wrong.
Speaking of our performative roles, it was like, when he talked about subject and object, like we were supposed to be perfect objects and return beauty to men, quote unquote. So it was like embedded in his like four position foundation teaching, like that was our role, you know.
I was thinking about this last night as I was like walking home from meeting up with like a bunch of old coworkers for happy hour, and I'm like, you know, like, it's not just the performative aspect of like when you're having sex, like you mentioned, Renee, but like it sort of permeated into the rest of my life of like needing to entertain or like be there as like the entertainment or performance for other people around me, and like constantly wanting to like being like, oh, like I have to be the one with all the interesting stories or all the jokes and like, and making sure everybody is cared for and they like, you know, are enjoying their meal and just being like the geisha, I guess, like the like hostess that's.
Well, that intersects with like living for the sake of others and putting yourself last and all the other, you know, thought stopping coercive tactics used while we were being raised.
Yeah, I do feel it particularly on, I mean, of course, everybody does on dates, like you want to put your best foot forward and things like that. But it's like this, it almost takes on like I'm a different person.
Yeah.
Like I am this entertainer version of me that's not really me.
Mm-hmm. This weird thing that you need to live for the sake of others and put your own pleasures back and stuff. Yeah, that's also permeating work life a lot, I feel, that we let ourselves get exploited at work.
Yeah.
So that not even for the company, right? Like fuck the companies, but for the people that we work with, our colleagues that we love and that we care for, we don't want to have them have more work because we slack or like because we are sick. So even if I was like super duper sick and I couldn't go to work, my worry was not what does the boss think about it. My first worry was, I hope my colleagues get by.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like the structure with the nursing saved me from that because I had that mentality as a bartender to put in most of the work, to do all the things to make, you know, but then in nursing, there's a structure where you have a certain patient limit and there's a scope of practice and there's safety protocols in place. So you don't take too much. And so that helped shape me to realize where my boundaries were, where my limits were. If a patient was crashing, ask for help. Like, because the side effect of me practicing Reverend Moon's teachings would be somebody would die if I didn't ask for help. You know what I mean, Misook? Like if you have a patient crashing in a trauma, like you need to get two IVs, you need somebody to get the heart, the meds, and you need somebody on airway. Like you can't do it by yourself, because if you do try, somebody's going to die. So that environment of having to depend on other people helped me recover from the idea that I have to do everything on my own, because the reality is you can't do it all on your own in certain situations.
For me, the living for the sake of others still influenced how I was as a nurse, because wanting to not let someone die, like, yes, like that scared the shit out of me, but also like I obviously you need teamwork, it takes more than one person to save someone's life, but it was because I was like I cared so much about not letting that person die that I became really good. You have to be good at delegating, you have to be good at communicating, doing all these things to save this person's life. So I became good at it because I think it stems a lot from living for the sake of others for me, like wanting to be good at that.
I feel like there's a step in living for the sake of others where you put yourself last, and that's ultimately not sustainable,
right?
Which is what we did. But then there's the proper way of helping, which is where you build yourself up, you build up your skills, you take care of your needs, you take care of your wants, you learn your limitations, and you learn what you're good at. And naturally, through knowing yourself and doing the work that you're good at, you do create a sustainable way of giving back and creating a safe environment. I think we were taught that end goal without all the stepping stones.
Right.
We were taught to be that person without all the things that would create a sustainable community in which that is realized.
Right. Just depleting yourself versus like caring
yourself
enough to take care of someone else.
Yeah. Like Yeah, like it's a perfect analogy, like throwing a kid to do CPR when they don't even have the basic life support skills, versus training a nurse to go through the schools, understand the meds, understand the airway, understand the H's and T's, and actually be able to sustain that person without killing themselves or without being traumatized by the situation. It's really about building people up from the ground instead of, just cutting them off at the legs like we were.
Do
you mind if I change gears a little bit?
Oh yeah, go for it.
I wanted to touch on like slut shaming and how, so even though I was getting like acting like a normal teen, I guess, by 14, 15, 16, I still very much had this idea in my head that my worth was based on how many people I slept with. And even into my early 20s, it was like I was keeping like a number count and being like, oh, what does this mean if I add another person? Like, what does this mean if this person that I'm sleeping with isn't like the one? And like, I have to keep sleeping with more people and having sex with more people, like adding more people to my list. And like, what would that mean for my self-worth? What does that make me? Does that make me less? And I very much felt that. I thought that for like the longest time, and it was really damaging to me.
Yeah. So have you been able to untie value and worth with sexual
I very
pleasure?
much, I think I have, especially with like that. I just look back on like my younger self and like how I did slut shame, and it was like, even though I didn't believe in the church and like all of the church's sayings and like actively was trying to rebel against it, at the same time it still worked its way into my psyche and my worldview.
Wow.
I think it doesn't help probably that our whole society does that too. It reinforces it quite a bit, I think.
You being in Germany, do you feel like, because I know some European societies are much more like lax about it, or at least a little bit more lax than the US. Did you feel like there was, I don't, did you have any comparisons that you were able to make?
Sure. So, I mean, I know that the state of how people in the US see morality and sexuality and like the intersection of those things is quite a bit different. But yeah, there are people here who they're not as outspoken, but they still will say shit. I mean, men. Mostly cishet men will say shit like, this number is too high for a woman to have slept with this many men. But it's not the other way around, right? Like, if a guy has slept with a lot of women, he's a total stud. One guy told me this really, really disgusting sentence. He basically said, if you're key opens every door, you have the master key. But if your door or if your lock opens for every key, your lock is broken.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Jesus.
How many times have we been compared to, like, what is it, a piece of tape?
Objects,
A cup
flowers.
of water.
Yeah, or chewed up gum.
My God. You cannot equate a person to objects. And if you do, you're participating in sex trafficking, like, or human trafficking. Like, to equate somebody's value to an object is to reduce their value as a human. And then you can treat them like currency easier if you view people like that. And
Didn't even think about that, but that makes total sense.
yeah. And that's what, yeah, and that's what we're, because like, if a girl in the Unification Church got raped or assaulted or had a boyfriend or experienced some type of sexual experience, then they were automatically shunned, not part of this conversation. They were part of the fallen group, and the fallen group is not allowed to talk in the group of pure people. We're not allowed to talk about them. It's like a really binary thing. And in that, like, that person, what does that do to somebody's self-worth? What does that do? What does treating people like this do besides damage both parties? Just why are we bifurcating people into fallen and pure and treating people like shit?
Did we talk about these knives yet? I think we haven't talked about these little knives that they were getting. This is something that I heard in passing. They didn't do it in Germany, I think. But also I left in 2002 or something. So maybe it happened here too. And I have no idea that it did. But Renee, I think you know what I'm talking about though, right?
I think the older generation was told to carry knives on them for if they were raped, and if they couldn't kill the person assaulting you, you would kill yourself. I think that later translated, and I heard multiple speeches where instead of carrying knives, if you're being sexually assaulted and your purity is about to be taken, you should bite off your tongue, which will flood your lungs with blood, and you will drown in your own blood, remaining pure. And you do this before you get raped. Now, I remember this speech and it impacted me very deeply because when I was being sexually assaulted, I tried to bite off my tongue and I could not do it. Like, put your tongue between your teeth and imagine chomping down. Like, that's what I was focusing on to disassociate when I was being assaulted. I was trying to bite my tongue off. So that speech was very real and it had very real consequences. Instead of like trying to save myself or get out or realizing that I was assaulted, I felt shame that I couldn't kill myself. And that had lingering effects of like self-sabotaging behavior and low self-worth. And instead of like getting the help I needed, I just like shut down and I was like, I'm not good enough. I wasn't even good enough to kill myself. Like, what does that do to somebody? Realistically speaking, like, these aren't just bedtime stories you tell a bunch of kids. Like, these have real world consequences on so many more people than we can even imagine. And this is the stuff the Messiah is saying. What? Kill yourself.
Yeah.
Seriously?
Like, that's how much our value was tied to our quote unquote purity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if you couldn't do it, then you have no place. There's no place for you. There's no place to speak about your experience. There's no place for therapy. I told plenty of first generation, did any of them suggest therapy? No, they were just like, well, you're still a virgin. You can still go to the seven, you know, the blessing. It's fine. It's going to be fine. I'm like, no, that's not the conversation. The conversation is, are you okay? What right. can I do to make you feel like you're still valuable? What can I do to make you feel like you're still in your body and you still have autonomy? What can I do to help you heal from this trauma, this very real trauma? What can I do to make you know that you're still loved? What can I do to bring you back into yourself? Not, it's okay. You can still go to the blessing. There might be other second generation.
You can still go and marry a stranger.
Yeah.
Right? You can still go marry a stranger and then get raped by this person, basically.
Yeah. And rape is a real issue in the Unification Church. Like it is, because there's no concept of consent.
I also have a history of sexual trauma, and I remember talking to my therapist about it, and I distinguished that like there is the trauma and, you know, the PTSD from that, but there's also a secondary emotional trauma from the way people reacted when I told them.
Mm-hmm.
So I was 19, I was still involved in the church. I remember I told my mom about it. I told one of the youth pastors about it. And they recommended I go to Back on Track, which I don't know if you know about that program, but it's a program for people that it's very secretive. You're not supposed to say names. You're not supposed to say who you went with. And it's so shaming. And I literally felt like I had to take responsibility for my actions, even though I was an unwilling participant. And that secondary emotional trauma is something that still affects me today, even though it happened like 10 years ago.
Did you go to that program?
I did.
What was, you don't have to share, but what was, if you want to, what was that like? Like, what did they do and say? And
it was a long time ago, but it was like just very shaming. Like, it's kind of like you feel like a lost hope because, you know, everyone there grew up in the church and had sex, and there was like 8 girls and 2 guys, like 3 guys there, and we had to like talk about it. It was like a 3-day workshop or something, and then we read some parts of the DP, and I ended up dating a guy I met there. I guess in my head I thought like we're both damaged, so we'll both be able to put up with each other's shit, but he ended up being super toxic. But like, why did I think I deserved that?
You could only pair up with those people. That wasn't in your head. That was a reality that was told to you. You're damaged goods. You can marry damaged goods. And there's a small pool of them, so you better pick one best. That's absolutely a reality. That was not just in your head. You did that because that's how you were groomed to survive. And I'm sure it was this chapter 2. They would equate us to Eve and say, this is our restorative path. It was our fault that Lucifer, whatever, we tempted them with our tiny teenage bodies. And it's our path of redemption, indemnity, restoration, all those words.
The only one good thing that came out of that workshop was that for the first time, I talked to other women about the fact that I masturbated. And then 2 other women spoke about it. And until that point, I did not know that other girls in the church masturbated, because it was never talked about in my whole life, like since I was 12, 13. And I was 19, I finally realized that other girls in the church also masturbated. And I was like, oh, I don't have to fucking beat myself up about this anymore. Like, yeah. It was crazy for me.
Let's talk about that. What is masturbation? Let's talk about it. Masturbation, for me, I've been thinking about it. Masturbation, it's not like everything spectacular that they've been like promising. Like it's a way to, it's like they built it up so much more than it really is. What it is it's a release. It's a natural built-in reset button for our bodies, for stress, for emotions,
for pleasure.
It's for pleasure. It's a reset. It's a release. You get a flood of dopamine. It's healthy. It's healthy for you. That is all it is. God gave it to you so that you could survive this crazy fucking life. Like, it is a reset button. Do it all you want. It feels good. It's not for anybody else. It's for you. Like, but we were never told that. Mm-hmm. We were never told
that. My mom actually told me that I can get AIDS from touching myself.
What?
Oh my God.
She was really big on the scare tactic.
Oh my God.
My mom too. Oh God.
Holy shit. Really? Oh no, I thought my mom was like the only weird.
Just like the scare tactics. My mom used that.
Oh, my mom was so scared for us. She was so scared for me. Jesus. I was going to public school all my life, so she felt like there is temptation everywhere.
I'm a huge advocate for masturbation because I want to say, like, whatever happened to me, I emotionally castrated myself. Yeah. And for women, masturbation is so, so deeply intrinsically attached to emotional and mental health. And because I had such a disconnect with my clitoris, like, I didn't even know my clitoris could do anything because I castrated myself because I had to. So I remember seeing a woman masturbating with a shower head in a movie. And I was like, does that work? And I did it. No reaction, nothing. I was like, this doesn't even work. Like, what is this even for? Mm-hmm. Like, I had emotionally and mentally castrated myself. And not until the language of purity culture came around or whatever, I was like, oh, I can fix this. If it's an emotional and a mental castration, that means it's not physical. I can still fix this. I can still fix this relationship with my body that God has given me, and it doesn't matter if you believe in God or whatever. That's just a euphemism that I have. And it is my gift and nobody else's. And so like, it's my sexual journey of wellness and healing started with realizing that I have to mend this relationship with myself mentally, emotionally, and physically. And that's when I got a bunch of vibrators and figured out which one was the best for me. And
yes.
Yeah. found a safe place, what I liked, and invited my husband into the journey. And it's been super healing to just like be able to give that language, because it's a really real thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I masturbated super early.
I did too.
Yeah, like in elementary school.
Yes. Yeah. Very young. And it was like before I even, but I still had this concept in my head of like, it's bad and I need to hide it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's dirty.
Yes.
It can make you sick. God is always watching. So that's cool, I guess. Yeah.
And when, you know, like we had this conversation with before, and she was like, yeah, you know, like I tell my daughter, you know, okay, well, a lot of people do this in their bedroom. So maybe just go up to your bedroom, like to do that. But like, it's explaining it to a kid in a very like scientific, like, I don't know, like medical terminology. And it was just like, God, I wish I had that.
Yeah. Yeah.
There are a couple of really good TV shows that explain it super well. And I wish that they were around when I was a kid, like Sex Education and Big Mouth. I think it's
fantastic.
It's super gross and not everyone is into musicals, I guess, but Big Mouth, big shout out.
Right? Because what they're doing is teaching about boundaries and safety and privacy. Yes. These are all like intersections of sexual wellness. And if you talk about these things, you can grow into a sexually healthy person instead of like some streaking pedophile that doesn't know about boundaries or like so many things.
And did you guys remember like workshops? Like, I guess in high school where guys and girls would be separated. My mom didn't even want me to attend workshops, so I didn't really go to many, but I remember there used to be a guys talk and a girls talk, and I'm pretty sure in the guys talk, they used to talk about masturbating, but we never got that talk. We never even had that language or space to talk about it. So like, if you think about how much shame was built from that, it's like for women, it's insane.
I asked my middle brother once, one of my brothers, I asked him if he remembers anything at all, because all my siblings are younger, and once I left, everyone left. So most of them didn't even really go to workshops. Doesn't mean that they were not impacted, which I found out recently. But he said that he only remembers listening to someone talk about masturbation and saying that it's not good and you shouldn't do it. But he was such a young child back then that he was like, I'm going to go play now, but like play something else, because he didn't even think about it. Mm-hmm. And I remember also like in a open discussion group with other like older kids, someone asked about masturbation, and this person, I don't even remember who it was, but this person told us that the more we masturbate, the more our bodies in spiritual world will get gray and die off. So you run around with like a visual representation of how much you masturbate, basically, and just advertise it to all of your fellow Moonies that are dead with you, I guess. That freaked me out, man. That really freaked me out.
Wow.
Holy shit. I mean, wow. That freaks me out.
Right. That's super creepy. Like, imagine just being all gray and crackly while everyone looks normal, and they know exactly what you did.
Listen, but everyone else is not going to look normal. Everyone else is also going to be crazy.
Just a bunch of gray people running around.
What the fuck? Like, it's so extensive. There's so many layers.
Also, the high noon, is it? That's like one of the, and they're like, their whole focus is like anti-porn. And like, don't get me wrong, the porn industry has its problems. They have issues. They do traffic women into porn and like children. But like, is porn itself problematic? I think like that is way too far of a stretch, you know.
I thank my local sex workers for choosing to do what they do. They are heroes, just like firefighters and police officers, because they're willing to give that service. You know, somebody has a sexual outlet, that's good, because when you don't have a sexual outlet, there's higher rates of rape or suicide or, you know, crime. Like, I thank my local sex workers. I think that's wonderful. If they choose to do that and they choose to be that person, great. But when you're talking about porn that's non-consensual, which they're
that's not porn, that's just a crime.
That's a crime. That's right. And they're focused on intake of porn for control purposes. I really don't understand what their focus is on getting everybody to stop masturbating and stop watching porn. Weird.
I think porn has very different problems than just trafficking, which is obviously bad enough. But I feel like it also reinforces disgusting racial stereotypes and also gendered stereotypes about what a woman should perform like in bedroom, and also what men should perform like in bedroom. And also it causes a whole bunch of body dysmorphia for whatever genitals you have, because genitals that are shown in porn are very, very like a narrow margin of what genitals actually look like.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, it's not that I don't enjoy porn, I do, but I'm also not a 15-year-old child that doesn't know what a normal body looks like and has had sex yet. So I don't know who said it, but like I've heard it way back when someone told me once that porn to regular sex translates like Fast and Furious to riding a car. Sometimes.
Makes sense.
And I think like this is being recognized more, you know, and like there are Belessa is B-E-L-L.
Belessa House.
Belessa, yeah. That's like a site that's run by a queer woman of color. And like there is
ethical porn out there, yes, for sure.
Yeah, yeah. It's starting to come more into mainstream. People are talking about it. And I think we need to have these conversations. But to label all of it like as like bad and you shouldn't look at it at all, like that's also problematic.
Yeah. What I like to do is just actually follow the porn people that I like on social media, just to remind myself that they're actual people.
Yeah.
And most of them are super entertaining and funny and goofy and parents and have partners. Yeah. And I think that humanizes them quite a bit. And for anyone who has trouble, you know, seeing them as people, just follow them on Instagram, man. They're fun.
I love this. You guys are so educated and just really represent that. That's really, really beautiful. I love that. Thank y'all for talking about that.
I mean, I've been watching porn for like, I don't know, 20 years now. So
that's so, so beautiful. I guess my issue with porn when I was in the church is that I thought that that's what sex was supposed to look like. So when I got blessed, I tried to be performative like a porn star. And it was really damaging because obviously I wasn't in my body. I wasn't being authentic. But also acting like a porn star, I think, created performance anxiety for my spouse as well, because when you can't be yourself, or somebody's acting, if somebody's performing like me, if I'm performing the way I think I should, then I'm also in turn, that's going to have an effect on my partner who I'm being intimate with. So they're going to have some type of performance anxiety without even knowing it subconsciously, because now sex doesn't become an act of love and pleasure. It becomes a performance, and who's watching? Besides spirit world, nobody. So, you know, when you're performing, you can't really be in your body. You're worried more about what the audience is thinking. And I think it further created a disconnect in our relationship, because it was our first relationship. And it was pretty damaging to sexual health for me. I can't speak for my partner because he's not here, but.
I recently was told about chatterbait. Which is like,
what's that?
it's like the combination of chatter cams and masturbating. Like, it's like, remember when all those like video, I don't know, sites came up where you can talk or watch like random people. So like you can, it's just a whole bunch of random people like having sex, but recording themselves like in live time, like actual real couples. And like, you can see like a whole bunch of different stuff on there. So I've been meaning to look into it and like, see what that's all about. Because apparently it's much more real, I guess, a lot more along the lines of like, what is the video site that like a lot of people are using now to like get money from? OnlyFans.
OnlyFans.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, similar to OnlyFans. Yeah.
Interesting. I know people who post porn on like regular porn sites. They are a couple and they enjoy themselves a lot. And when they decided to film themselves, and then they said people will pay money for this. They are. I think that's so cool.
That is cool.
I love that. So that reminds me of our sex talks, you know, at Blessing and Matching Workshops. There would be like those couples that come around and be like, yeah, we have sex all the time. I'd be like, those people would be candidates. They would really enjoy doing that. Somebody send them the link.
Could make money for the church.
Yeah. Oh, no. So I guess we're getting to the end of, you know, not 90 minutes or whatever. We're putting down the foundation for purity culture and purity talks later on this podcast of Blessed Child. I think we've talked so deeply about purity culture. And there's so much left to be said. I just want to let our audience know that there's going to be a questionnaire. If you want us to touch on any more subjects, just drop us a comment or message me or email me, and I'll put the links in the show notes. I really enjoyed this conversation. I feel like we covered a lot of ground without getting too deep into the theology, just that it's there and that it happened and that there's long lasting injuries from it. And there's language that can be created and you can heal from it and you can grow from it and just acknowledge that it happened and move forward is definitely something possible. And sexuality is not binary. It's not a box. It's not a one-way road. It is so, so diverse. There are so many aspects to it. And shame does not have to be part of the equation.
And it definitely can't be dictated by some random Korean dude.
Yes.
Who knows nothing about you.
Or sex, apparently.
Yeah.
Or women.
Right. Yeah. Where are the female advocates? I know Reverend Moon talked about sex all the time, but did Hawk John ever whisper about sex ever?
I never heard her really speak.
That in and of itself is like super telling.
That about was what was modeled for a woman, a perfect woman, someone who doesn't talk and doesn't talk about sex. Like,
but her husband can tell people like, oh yeah, swallow your husband's cum. It's good for you. It'll help you heal. But a woman can't be like, yeah, get like whatever vibrator you want. Like,
or also never were women told to just sit on their husband's faces. if he has a throat pain, they should just sit on his face to cure him. Right? You never heard that. Or like,
right, yes. Vaginal fluid is not poisonous, guys. It can cure
stomach. It's not.
Upset stomach? Try some vaginal fluid.
Perfectly fine.
I mean, if that's the intellectual thought process in the church, like, you could totally make commercials for women's bodily fluids, like, being the cure-all.
Yes.
My God. But Yeah, we'll go further into. So we talked about the purity culture. The next talk we'll have is we'll figure it out. It'll be open. It'll be open for discussion.
This is part of the series. Yes.
Yeah. Is there anything you guys want to say as we finish?
Well, to the audience that might be listening that grew up in the church or in any, you know, purity culture thing, the thing that was the biggest realization for me is that girls watch porn. I think we need to talk about that. Like, girls masturbate and there's nothing wrong with that. It's totally healthy. It's totally normal.
To all the people who are listening and struggling with whatever they are dealing with because of purity culture, it can get better. It doesn't have to stay like this. You can get through this and you will come out at the end stronger and wiser and more in touch with yourself. It's totally, it's a reachable goal. It's not something that, you know, it's not a dream. You can do this.
And along with that, I want to like add that, you know, sex positivity and sex positive like websites and Instagram accounts, and like that's out there. So like if you just do, you know, Google searches or search on social media, like it's out there to be found. And that can be also very healing. I found a lot of really good Instagram sites that I was like, oh, this is really helpful in helping me like shape my thinking.
Yeah. I think when you can enjoy masturbation, that opens up the doorway for you to be able to communicate with your body on so many different levels. First, there's masturbation is instinctual and biological, but then you get better at communicating with yourself about your feelings about a certain person or your feelings about a certain situation or certain acts. And it bleeds into everything. And it hasn't been said enough that sexual health and sexual wellness is just as real as emotional health, as real as mental health, as real as physical health. It is such an important part of your whole person. So it's not something to be ashamed about. And masturbation is not something to be ashamed about. And whatever you need, you know. So I'm just so happy that y'all could join today as a panel of experienced survivors from the Unification Church, and that you could share your wisdom. And I am looking forward to more talks with many more people. And I hope this opens up a dialogue for a lot of healing for a lot of people. You guys are so brave, and I appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting us all, and thank you for organizing this. This was very interesting and eye-opening, and thank you all for sharing and being vulnerable. I think that's really hard, so kudos to you.
All right, bye ladies. You have a wonderful, wonderful day. I'll speak again soon.
Yeah, you guys too.